You're listening to Powder Radio, brought to you by Powder Magazine. I'm Hadley Hammer, and this is Nausicaa Cast. Tune in each month as I dive into the lives of the leading ladies of the ski world. This week, I'm talking with ski mountaineer Hillary O'Neill. Hillary has made first descents all over the world. She has been named one of the most adventurous women in the outdoor sphere. But when you talk to Hillary, you get the impression that her adventures aren't a series of tick lists, but rather an inspiring curiosity about adventure and life. I hope you enjoy the conversation this week.
Can you hear me?
Hi, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
Perfect. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Good, thank you so much for doing this.
Cool.
So yeah, maybe we can start it from the beginning and talking about, you know, you plan on spending one winter in Chamonix, and then I think it said you stayed for about 5 years, and that place is so, it can be very daunting and a little bit overwhelming, and what the process was from going as a lift serve skier to a skier that can handle the technical terrain and mountaineering terrain of Chamonix.
Okay, so Chamonix for like one winter. Like I basically moved there in 96, which is a really long time ago. I'm really old, and I really thought I was just going to be there for a few months. And I'd only ski toured, you know, maybe 20 times or something. I was pretty pretty new. I went to university in Colorado, so I'd skied a few 14ers and done a little bit of backcountry and thought I knew a lot more than I did, but I'd never seen a glacier in my life or anything. So I think what worked in my favor the most was just total ignorance. When I first moved to Chamonix, obviously, I was of the era of like Blizzard of Oz and those movies that like inspired me to go to Chamonix in the first place. Again,
and were you
myself.
Were you going to, because you wanted to become a professional skier, or just to have like to get more ski experience in general?
The latter. I was going just to experience Chamonix and experience sort of the Alps and like the crazy, like I feel like that year, 96, was like a really incredible year for skiing in general, for ski mountaineering, for this whole like scene of Shane McConkie and Aaron McGovern and just this whole like really rootsy sort of Kristen Ulmer, the sort of foundation for what sort of become the free ski movement and ski mountaineering and all of that over the last 20 years. And I just happened to walk into it by chance. And I moved there not thinking I was going to make my entire life in climbing mountains, but just to, like, you know, see a little bit of this coolness that was, like, Kristen Ulmer and that whole group of people that sort of put Chamonix on the map for young Americans.
Yeah.
And maybe partway through that first year, I was talked into doing the first extreme skiing comp. And, I mean, I think there are literally three women, and I won. It was, it was a very shallow field at that point. And I don't know, it was just kind of one thing led to another. Like, I just became really fascinated with this whole notion of insane lift access combined with this really technical going uphill and I was never this like huge, fast Alaskan style skier. I was always really more techy and precise and that kind of a skier.
Uh-huh.
It's really played into that part of me. And I don't know, I just loved it. It was such a wild, wild scene at that point. And so as that winter ended and the girlfriends that I moved there with all went back home, I just ended up staying. And I lived there in the summers, and I lived there in the winters, and it went on for like 6 years.
That's all. And did you find mentors there that were helping you learn? I mean, the mountains there are no joke. And how was it finding people to help you gain those skills to move through the mountains safely?
I really look at that time as kind of my second university, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I literally survived that first winter. I didn't know it better. I was so lucky not to die.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, sort of the end of that winter, going into the next year and realizing that, I was too young to be, say, like, I was faced with my mortality or anything like that, but to just realize that, like, whoa, these are big mountains. There's a whole, like, thing going on here that I don't know anything about. And I really need to kind of take a step back and start learning, like, go back to square one. And I had to relearn my whole ski technique. I had to relearn backpack, just everything basically. And so in that, with that sort of attitude going into the second season, I did find some great mentors, and I did try a lot of different things in skiing and took avalanche courses and just tried learning more than just thinking I knew everything. Have you spent time in Chamonix?
I have, yeah, just for competitions.
Right. It's a really intense place. They're super intense. The valley's intense. People die a lot there. And, I don't know. I got really into it for a while. There was definitely quite a few years there I didn't think I would ever leave.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, it's like such, I remember my first experience there and skiing off the gi, and you're just like, whoa, this is huge. Everything here is huge, and all the consequences are huge.
Right, and I think I didn't realize it at first, watching these people, like, pushing themselves and doing these crazy things and just thinking that that was, like, standard and normal. It's a really, really big, scary university, if you could call it.
Yeah. And then what made you decide to leave?
Kind of all the things that attracted me in the first place were sort of what made me leave in the end. It was that I had a lot of friends die, and it felt like every year I was there, it was just getting closer and closer. And I think I noticed in myself this flippancy almost, this sort of disregard for, for death and just taking risks that probably weren't the best choices I could have made. And it just seemed to always compound itself. And you kind of get caught up in that mentality there of, like, what'd you do today? Like, how hard did you push yourself? Like, and if you weren't doing that every day, then, you weren't really living the full Chamonix life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just scared me. The real pivotal turning point for me was the winter of 99. When Chamonix just had, like, this crazy, crazy amount of snow, and there were avalanches, and the whole town of Mont-Roc got wiped out by an avalanche, and it was just, I felt in over my head, basically. went a little out of control. And I think that was when I finally realized that I was going to probably end up leaving there sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But then, I mean, to an outsider's perspective, your life has continued to be, I guess, one of more risk than most.
Yeah, true. I think part of the impetus for me leaving Chamonix in 2001 was kind of all of those things I mentioned as far as, you know, friends and dying and all of that. But I did go home and ended up learning more, taking like a level 3 AVI course. I started guiding up in Alaska at that point, and I learned a ton from that sort of fast paced downhill skiing and in that environment. And now when I go back to Chamonix, I love it. I just think that I didn't learn. I needed to get away from there and learn a lot more and get more experience. And now I can kind of go back and, like, I have my own confidence and my own personality. And at that point, at that age in my life, I was very subject to influence. I think that's the biggest difference, probably.
Yeah. That's so interesting. It's kind of, I mean, this is a little off topic, but it's interesting. I think in today's world, you had, say, 5 to 7 years of a lot of time spent learning and getting all this education. And it's interesting to see so many people now that are starting to make this transition between, like, big mountain free skiing into more high-risk ski mountaineering. And
right.
So, I mean, even personally, I think, like, okay, I go on these trips that have more mountaineering focus, but I know I don't have the experience, but you almost feel stressed about not having the time.
Right.
To learn everything.
Right. It's hard. I mean, I had the luxury back then of not necessarily knowing that I was going to be a professional skier, mountaineer person. And it happened pretty gradually for me. I mean, a funny story. So 99 was the first year I went on my first expedition, and I was still living in Chamonix, and it was with North Face. And I had this interview with North Face, and I had just skied, what's it called? Off Buck Mountain. Sorry, my phone's beeping. Buck Mountain.
With Figginshaw.
With Figginshaw, yeah.
Oh, what is it called?
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe I can't remember what it's called. But it's a huge rap at the bottom, and it was, like, super intense. And honestly, I didn't even know what I was getting into. I was just going with a couple friends, and I was like, oh, sweet, sounds like fun. Like, we did it in January. It was freezing cold. I had, like, alpine boots on and, like, alpine truckers and plastic skins and God, it was such a disaster. And right after that, I met with North Face, and they're like, oh, my God, you just did this crazy descent. You must be, like, some insane female ski mountaineer. And
yeah.
They're like, we want you to go to India and film with Rick Armstrong and Jeremy Nobis and do this big 1,000-foot peak. And I was just, like, totally – like, yeah, definitely. I've done that. Sure. That sounds great. I'd never even flown in a helicopter before.
Oh, man.
Well, on one hand, I took all this time to learn. There was definitely that bit of, like, throwing yourself into the fire, too.
Yeah. That's crazy. I guess that could be a good segue to talk about, I mean, you go on your first North Face expedition. And obviously,
yeah. There's
so many unknowns for you. And what are sort of the differences between the unknowns that you had then versus your trip to Burma that seemed riddled with, like, a million things that couldn't be predicted? And how do you think it's changed your approach to dealing with factors of a trip that you can't control at all?
Again, it kind of goes, you know, I mean, from that first expedition to Burma, which was just about 2 years ago, I've probably done close to 40 expeditions in between. And I went from sort of being a deer caught in headlights and just showing up on a trip and not knowing what was working well and what wasn't. Like, I just really had no idea. To coming up with the ideas and putting the expeditions together and creating the team and taking on this huge workload of planning, you know, a 2 month expedition to an incredibly remote place is so difficult to plan. And in between all of that were just sort of baby steps along the way. And I think, you know, Burma is a really extreme example, but the difference would just be that I still love adventure. And I hope that part of me never goes away. And adventure happens when the best laid plans go awry. So no matter, regardless of the fact that I spent over a year planning this trip to Burma, obviously things happen that you just could never imagine. And honestly, that's, you know, I mean, I have to remind myself of this sometimes, but that's what I'm going out and looking for, are those kind of places where the unexpected happens and you have to think on the fly and you have to be flexible. And early on in my career, I was able to do that without knowing that was actually kind of a skill set. And now I'm more aware that that's what I'm looking for and that's what I need to make myself happy and stay passionate about what I do.
And you, I mean, are you've talked about, I mean, the Burma trip, in the interviews that I read it, you mentioned that it was kind of the trip that broke you, but it sounds like you also still want to go back.
Yeah, Burma threw out a bunch of dynamics. I mean, Burma was actually the first expedition that I didn't bring skis on, which was kind of
oh,
funny.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I went purely as like an alpine climber, and I think I had a lack of confidence in that regard. It's funny how ski mountaineering is not regarded necessarily by an alpinist as alpinism, yet you spend a lot of time solo climbing really sketchy things as a ski mountaineer.
Yeah.
Because a ski mountaineer, and technically you're not an alpine climber, and so you don't bring a rope or whatever it is, even though you're on this scary stuff. So even with that, I had a lack of confidence, and I think the way the group dynamics played out and the team dynamics and everything, it really played into my lack of confidence, and therefore that was where this really big struggle came into play for me. You know, it was a big pressure trip because it was my first sort of National Geographic grant. And that's a big deal when you talk about how do you fund these really expensive expeditions. And I just had a lot of pressure on myself. And, yeah, all those factors kind of came together in a unique way that was really challenging for me.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of the process that goes on in your head when you are in these moments where you, confidence is almost the most important thing for your survival, and when you don't have it, how you kind of, are you able to step back and realize like, oh, okay, I'm not feeling confident and I need to gain that back, or is it kind of just this process that doesn't happen until you're back off the trip?
Well, Burma, to go back to Burma, that's a perfect example. Like, I made it, you know, 95% of the way up the mountain, and then I had essentially my climbing partner tell me that he didn't think I had the skills to go any further. And I strongly, vehemently disagreed. But at the same time, that night before the summit push the next day, I realized that due to that conversation the day before, two things had changed. And one was my own personal confidence, and the second one was the trust. So those are the two biggest factors for me when it comes to making that sort of critical decision to push on or to throw in the towel. And in the case of Burma, I thought the trust was gone and my confidence had been taken down a lot of notches. And that morning I decided not to go ahead and stay at the high camp. So, you know, does that sort of formula work perfectly every time? No, not necessarily, because you don't always know what conditions you're going to come across. But I think those are really like the biggest two factors for me in terms of that ever important decision of persevering or coming back another day.
Huh. Interesting. And I guess, how do you deal with that idea of you've come back from these expeditions and it seems like you're on like 3 or 4 a year? And I know reentry into the real world can be a little bit intense. Is it different for you whether the trip has been quote unquote successful and you've summited and skied down versus not? Or is that reentry process the same no matter what?
It is different for me. I think, so I have 2 kids, and they're 9 and 7. And I have done, you know, considerably fewer expeditions since having kids. I used to do 3 or 4 a year, and now I'm at 1 or 2 a year. And so I pick and choose the things I want to do a lot more carefully. And I oftentimes they're sort of passion projects for me because it takes a lot for me to, you know, want to spend 7 weeks away from my kids. In the case of Burma, it was a 7-week trip. And there is some validation to coming home from a trip that's successful versus coming home from a trip that's a failure. And, you know, everyone always talks about, you know, it's not the goal, it's sort of the road along the way. And while I strongly agree with that so much of the things I remember about expeditions aren't standing on the summit, it's about all the craziness of planning it and getting there and getting out of there. At the same time, on a failed trip, I come home and it's definitely harder for me to move on, basically, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Reentry from any kind of big expedition back into the U.S. of A. and paying bills and phone calls and reflective surfaces and all of that is very difficult, but it is harder on a trip that has not been successful in traditional terms of like reaching the summit.
And do you think those pressures are coming from yourself or judgments from other people in society? Like, you are a mother, you're a female, like, you're taking risks.
Maybe a little bit of both, but definitely from myself, because I mean, there's just this sort of logic of like, oh, well, I summited, so I'm a little more justified in the time that I spent away from home versus, oh, I put all this time and effort. And even when I was home and planning the Burma trip, I was like obsessed over it, and it took time away from my kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, come home from a trip like that and it's not successful. But in terms of like, let's say my, like, climbing Everest and Lhotse was like my most successful trip.
Mm-hmm.
You take that trip and you take my most unsuccessful trip, which could be considered Burma, and you look at it from a public reaction, from a sponsorship reaction, and the Burma trip has fared much better and had films and stories about it, and people are like so amazed and curious about that trip versus this successful trip I had on Everest and Lhotse.
Yeah.
So, with that said, I think from a sponsor pressure or anything like that, I really don't necessarily think that the summit is the end all. It's the story and the adventure and how you can tell that story. But for me personally, I struggle with the success failure dynamic of it just because of, you know, the work I put into it and the time I spend away from home.
Totally. I think it's pretty interesting. I think maybe because skiing and ski mountaineering is kind of a hard concept for the general public to always understand. And it is funny, like, you'll have these seasons where everyone's like, wow, that season seems so successful for you. And you're like, oh, it was actually personally the worst season.
Right.
But it can get spun however anyone wants to at the time.
Right.
Huh.
It's, yeah, totally true.
What draws you? Oh, go ahead.
I just think, like, some of my most successful ski mountaineering trips were, like, first ascents in Mongolia and Russia. And, like, nobody's ever heard about any of those trips. So it's just funny.
Yeah.
How that works out.
What draws you to these specific mountains? Like, when you're... I mean, you're at the point where you are the one planning these trips and going, creating these ideas for expeditions. For a complete outsider, what's the process like of why you would choose one particular mountain to ski?
I think some of it is, like, I really... Sometimes I think I need to, like, rename myself from a mountaineer to, like, just an adventurer, in terms of the fact that that's often what draws me to pick certain lines, is that they're, like, totally in the middle of nowhere. And there's very little information on them, and it's all about doing this research, or there's some amazing cultural component or a big high altitude pressure, or, you know, just that is what draws me a lot of the times. I mean, I call myself, like, a ski carrier. Like, I'll go to I carry my skis for, like, 2 days, you know? I don't know what's wrong with me, but those are the things that are wrong. Oh, I think I have a problem.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think has led, you know, the North Face did their big campaign this year, was this idea of questioning madness and this idea of, like, we're doing these things and people think it's mad or crazy and all the athletes have their own explanation of why they do it. And one of the things I was thinking about was, man, like, I guess what you said, what is wrong with me? Like, technically speaking, I find it really interesting to be around people that can find joy out of really simple things. And for me, to figure out my personality and to work through my own personal struggles, I seem to need to go struggle somewhere else in a different way.
Right.
And have you ever reflected about why you think you need to go on these crazy adventures of unknowns and hardship and...
There is something about suffering that I think is really gratifying. We have so much as Western people. We have too much. And I feel like suffering is sort of shedding a lot of that and seeing how you live and seeing who you really are, whether it's pretty or it's ugly, whatever it is. But we don't do that a lot anymore. And I just, I get a lot from that. And I think, again, going back to Burma, like, I definitely saw a really unattractive side of myself, and I had to, like, come to terms with that and kind of, yeah, I don't know. There's this belief I have that, like, you can't have these highs and these incredible good times without a little bit of suffering in there. And that's what sort of getting out of your comfort zone is. I mean, this year I didn't go on any expeditions. I tried to totally do something different, and I ended up, my biggest goal this year was to complete an Ironman. And, like, I don't even know how to swim. I started swimming last year. Like, I started riding a road bike last year, and I just, like, worked my ass off all summer and taught myself to swim, taught myself to ride, like, running. Like, and all of this was, like, super painful and frustrating and suffering and awesome at the same time. Like, it's really good to suck at something and work through it and, like, get better. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like you feel the gain, like, when you just totally suck at a sport and you know your body and know your strengths, and then I think the little improvements with ski mountaineering and skiing, you kind of hit this point where you don't get these giant leaps of improvement, but then you go swimming and you're like, whoa, today I'm like,
yeah,
like 10 times better than yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Gratifying. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think's next for you in the realm that you're in?
Well, I feel like it kind of goes back to what I said about really picking and choosing some places and expeditions I want to go. And typically in my career, I've always, like, I'll go to one place and never go back, whether I'm successful or not. I just kind of like to move around and do different things. But kind of at this point where there's a few places that I have been that really have stuck with me, and I want to go back, like, and give them a second go, because, you know, a second try on something, you learn a lot from that first try. So I think that's what's up for me for the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, is kind of revisiting some old and mixed with maybe one or two new places, but definitely ski mountaineering oriented.
Yeah. How do you think, I mean, backcountry skiing now is growing so much and seems to be the biggest part of the sport that's changing. And with that, obviously, you know, it's more side country that seems to be increasing, but I would think at some point that might lead into people trying to tackle bigger mountains. How do you think ski mountaineering will change quite a bit? I mean, it's been a pretty...
I hope to see it become more popular in the U.S. I mean, I learned to ski mountaineer in Chamonix, which is like the birthplace of ski mountaineering, and the mountains in the Alps are incredibly, incredibly crowded, and there are people everywhere, and I mean, it's crazy. And then you come to the U.S., and over the last few years, I've definitely noticed a big increase in backcountry skiers, and I just hope people take the time to do it right and to learn about it and to understand it. But obviously with more backcountry users comes more backcountry accidents, just based on percentages. But I know how much I cherish the time I get in the backcountry, and it, how, you know, I bring my kids back there, and how special it is. And I think it'd be awesome to see the sport grow and to see people kind of have that respect with nature and sport and fun and the human sort of relationship you can develop through backcountry skiing. It's pretty amazing.
It's funny, it seems as if the gear sales of beacons, all of that, have increased so much, but I don't know if the sales of, like, Abbey level courses has matched that.
Probably they haven't matched that, but I do think, like, Abbey courses have, you know, the whole that whole school system for teaching people has grown a lot in the last decade.
Yeah.
So I do think people are seeking it out and, you know, hopefully the learning curve is there, but I see it growing. I don't know about, you know, big ski mountaineering expeditions because they're so time consuming and they are so expensive, but backcountry usage I see really growing, continuing to grow.
Yeah.
And then you have people like Jeremy Jones who, you know, don't heli-ski anymore. Like, they're kind of making an environmental statement about, you know, human-powered stuff. And that's awesome. And I think that also will inspire more people to start backcountry skiing and touring and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Do you see, I mean, I have no idea, obviously, what it's like to be that high in the, obviously, when you're doing these huge peaks where the mountaineering aspect is so different, do you see people being able to bring, like, a more free ride, freestyle aspect to skiing those larger mountains, or is it just survival skiing? Do you think it'll ever change from, like, kind of more of the survival aspect skiing to more of, like, a free ride skiing in these larger mountains?
I totally think it can be more free ride. I mean, I was in Greenland with Johnny Collinson and we found some really good snow and he was like hucking backflips in like pin binding set up off of like the lips of crevasses. And just, I mean, it was pretty free ride. I was like, oh God, don't so far removed from everybody. But like your skill level so high, you know, it's sort of what you're accustomed to. And it was pretty amazing to watch. So I do think there's, of course, it's condition dependent and, you know, how big your pack is that you're carrying and so on and so forth. But I like every aspect of skiing, it's growing and it's changing and people are looking at it different. That's the beauty of skiing and backcountry because it's such an art. To me, it's all about creativity, the going up as well as the going down. Mm-hmm. And it's just all about, like, how creative are you? It's cool.
Yeah. It is really cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to Nausicaa Cast. We hope you are inspired by the conversation with Hillary and are ready to get back into the mountains. We look forward to another conversation coming to you soon.